was music from the Praise Strings. Doug, you remember the Praise Strings, don't you?
I do. They were the Christian version of the 101 strings that Hollywood used to do the pop
stuff.
Yeah,
they were indeed. They were indeed. And so that particular album, there was a great series of albums, about three of them called the Praise Strings, and that one part of it, In Moments Like These. It's now 13 minutes past the hour, and we're joined by Doug Greenwald, who is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. And David, you're here too. I didn't want to forget the...
Yeah. Am I the only one that hears the music?
What music? You didn't hear any. Okay. I've got my buttons crossed here, and we'll get things back together here shortly. Oh, so just be calm.
So Jim is on his A game today.
I've been fouling things up here, but we'll get it together because we got important stuff to do. And Doug, you asked earlier via email. This is part six today of the parable of the prodigal of the lost sons. You've taken us deeper than anybody's ever gone into this, I think, and there's still stuff there to discover, isn't there?
Well, there is, you know. And as I was sitting at my breakfast table this morning, I had this thought. I'm always searching for analogies that try to underscore why context matters. Mm-hmm. And this has some flaws to it, but at the same time, I think it communicates. So what do you think of this? Would you ever walk out of a great two-hour movie at the 30-minute point, stand in a lobby and say, you know, this doesn't all make sense to me. I really couldn't discern what was going on.
That would be kind of a foolish thing to do, I would think.
Yeah, so there is a good reason to hang with one of these biblical stories for a longer period of time, to penetrate it, to get into its context. So we see the whole two-hour story, not just the first 30 minutes.
Well, this thing called the Bible is a whole lot more complex than most of us have ever realized or been taught growing up, even in the church, because the contextual. Well, that's what you're here for. That's what Preserving Bible Times does, and this is a particularly busy time of the year for you too. I know you've got an Advent series. What's coming up for the ministry?
Well, I want to just backtrack 30 seconds here. Mm-hmm. I don't want to create the impression that studying the Bible is a complex activity. You know, all of these stories were just told to average, unlearned peasant people. We have a challenge to get from the way we think to understand the way they thought, so that we can hear the words like they thought and therefore discern the original meaning of what Jesus was saying. That does take some work. I don't deny that. But I always want to lean against the notion that studying the Bible is complex, because I think it just scares people off. We do have to work. Paul exhorts us to present ourselves a workman approved, rightly handling the word of truth. And of course, the obvious implication is there must be a number of ways you can wrongly handle the truth. But while it takes work, it takes effort, it's the most exciting work that I've ever run across. It just thrills my day. It puts oxygen into my soul. And so I want to leave it that it's intriguing. It does take energy. It does take work. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's complex. Am I making sense?
Yes, you are. I mean, it can be difficult and simple, but it does call for work and time. And that's something that so many of us, well, we just don't have it. We've decided that other things get priority. But there's...
Well, the evolution of the microwave really has not served us well. Oh, it's gotten us our food faster.
Yeah.
But it also has trained us that we want to eat after 2 minutes on power 10.
Yep.
And you cannot do that with the Bible.
Instant gratification.
Yep.
That we're after. Yep. 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 Well,
you ask about this time of year.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're on the verge of Advent. And I will be in three states in December, in Connecticut and New Jersey and Texas, bringing two different messages, sometimes both of them on the same night. The first one is Zechariah and Elizabeth, the rest of their story, which is a contextual restoration of Luke 1. And when we do a double header, you know, there's a 15-minute break, and then I do another 75-minute presentation on Christmas in context, the real birth of Jesus. Some churches and some home fellowship groups, I'll just do one or the other and not both. But even though I have been sharing the context of Luke 1 and Luke 2 for 10 or 15 years now, every year there's something more that I've learned about those passages. And so every year it's fresh and new to me. It's like edition 15.0. And for example, and this is a good example of the cross ref that goes on, you know, now that we've started to do our Paul's Roman world contextual immersion experiences in Italy to as a companion to our contextual immersion experiences in Israel, you quickly learn when you go to the Roman, Paul's Roman world, that Augustus, the one who shows up in Luke 2 as the emperor who declared that there would be a census or a taxation, depending on which version of the Bible you read, was the first emperor living to be deemed a god, lowercase g. Julius Caesar was deemed a god after he died, posthumously, mostly with pressure from the eastern part of the Roman Empire, the Greeks, because of all the accomplishments that Julius Caesar had done to consolidate the empire. And then Augustus was his great nephew, and therefore divinity was conferred on him as well. Interestingly enough, Augustus never believed he was a god, but he certainly used it for political purposes to further consolidate the kingdom and almost put it at its high water mark, if you will. So this year, for the very first time, when I open up Luke 2, I need to talk about three kings, Augustus, Herod, and King Jesus. So, you know, that's just a little piece there. And then I learned something really pretty significant a couple years ago on one of our early trips to Paul's Roman world in Italy. You ever heard of a guy named Bart Ehrman? Does that name ring a bell?
Vaguely. You may have mentioned him.
He's a widely acclaimed professor at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill.
Yes, I have. He's the one that's so popular with the student body there.
And he's written books and does lectures and been voted most popular professor and all that. But his thing is debunking the Bible. He loves to poke holes in the Christian faith and the veracity of the Bible and the notion of inerrancy of the Bible. And so he'll say something like this when it comes to the birth narratives. There is absolutely no record that Caesar ever decreed a census or a taxation that at the year Jesus was born. Okay? Now, that's actually technically correct if you mean existing records. But what we learned when we went over to Italy was when the empire fell in like 475 AD, there was the sacking of Rome, and almost all the records were burned or destroyed. So you see, there's a little difference here. There were records. They just have been destroyed, and so they no longer exist. And so technically it's correct to say there is no record that claims this actually happened. Yeah, but there was. And then the records that remain tell us that every 5 years Rome did a census for the whole history of the empire. Well, that suddenly puts that whole thing in a different context, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, it makes it an intellectually dishonest claim.
Yeah, and well, that's a lot of what he does, okay? It's half-truths. It doesn't connect all the dots. It cherry-picks the facts, you know, the standard things that people use when they're trying to debunk the scriptures. And, you know, some Bibles will say census and some Bibles will say taxation, but learned also that Augustus was the first one to have a formalized Roman legion. They were all volunteer fighters prior to
that. Is it true that wasn't he the first emperor of the empire? Because prior to that, it was the Republic. He came to power shortly after the Republic had been broken up.
At the point of Julius Caesar and Augustus is where the Republic ends and the empire starts.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the imperial cult of godliness, lowercase g, is put in place. Okay. But anyway, Augustus's problem now is, now that he has a formal Roman legion, a standing Roman legion, he has to pay for it. So some feel that this particular census was also the first one that was going to be tied to a taxation to now pay for the Roman Empire. And for some, that was a sticking point and caused some revolts or, you know, around the empire. So all of this background pieces, all these contextual pieces come together in Luke 2. And so the story that I'm going to recreate and reweave this year will be bigger than it ever has been on Luke 1 and Luke 2.
Well, I hope it sounds like you're going to have a busy December. You're traveling a lot. I hope we get you one or two weeks during the month to cover some of that, because that's a great story. All right. Look forward to that. Look forward to that. And a man had two sons. We did. We spent about 3 weeks on that. Those words. There were so much packed into that. In the beginning of the parable of the prodigal sons, and I, for those new listeners this morning, it's meant to be plural, sons, because we've learned that the older brother had a whole lot to do with this story, even though he disappears for most of the story. Doug, where do we go in part six?
Well, remember the theme, one of the themes we've been developing over 5 or 6 weeks now, one of extreme. What the younger son did was an extreme response that no one, or initiative that no one had ever heard of before. The failure of the elder brother to act, to intervene, was an extreme situation that no one had ever heard of before.
And once again, just to back up for those who are now getting into the story, all that's established in the first two sentences. When Jesus says, a man had two sons, the reaction in that culture was, there's a younger and an older, and the older has a birthright issue. They know that's coming.
Absolutely, and with the birthright is the mandatory requirement to resolve all disputes between the father and the other siblings. That's why he has the birthright. That's his obligation, and the fact that he does not do that is an incredible statement. It speaks loudly that there's a huge problem with the elder brother and the father, as well as the younger brother and the father.
So as Westerners, we're hearing that parable, and we're forgetting about the older brother, because he's no longer part of the story. The young one makes his demands and goes off and lives a wild life, we're told. But the locals there listening to this parable are thinking all the time, well, where's the older son? Where is he?
Why doesn't he intervene?
Yeah,
even though the elder son isn't spoken of much in the text, he's in about every other verse as the story unfolds by implication, and we'll pick more of that up today. But where we ended this was on the notion of remembering. Things got so bad, again, the theme of extreme, that a Jew ends up tending pigs during a extreme famine. And even doing that doesn't feed him anything, and no one's giving him anything to eat. And he finally comes to the realization that he's dying. And he remembers. The verse that Jesus uses in Luke 15 is, he came to his senses. Now, how does a person come to their senses?
When they have no other choice.
When they're forced into it?
Mm-hmm. The back's against the wall. I'm speaking autobiographically here.
There's a really, really big theological issue in that statement, okay? Not to take sides on it, but just to point out that it's there. How do you come to your senses? Do you do that yourself, or are you prompted by the Holy Spirit?
Interesting question.
Usually you have help.
Yeah.
Some people deny that. Some people embrace that. Just want to make that observation.
I always like the phrase, it dawns on you. You know, it's like the sun coming up. That's something external to your own existence that intervenes and gets your attention.
A small aside, it's interesting to me that I've only accepted that in the rearview mirror. That I look back and say, oh, that's what it was, as opposed to living through it I say, wow, what an incredible heroic guy I am. Look, I'm saving myself.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the...
Nope, Doug, I think...
Your mic's your button again,
yeah. He's got a very sensitive little button, and if he leans forward at all, it turns off the microphone. He's still working on it here.
Yeah, I don't know how I keep doing that. I guess I get too energetic.
Put a piece of duct tape over that thing, and that'll fix it. Yeah.
But the longer we live, the more material there is to observe in the rearview mirror. And the easier it is to come to connect those dots and come to some realization. So age and maturity and distance can be a blessing. So anyway, he comes to his senses. And for me, that's just another indication of God's amazing grace. He nudges us when we're in these kinds of situations to remember, to come to our senses. And in this case, he remembers this. How many hired servants of my father have more bread than they can eat? And as for me, I am perishing here of hunger. And so on the surface of this parable, there are three things that he comes to remember, that he comes to realize. He remembers he has a father, and he remembers he has a home, and he remembers or realizes that he's dying, okay? And that points out the importance of remembering. And David, to pick up your theme there, the best way to remember is to deliberately set aside times in our life when we look through the rearview mirror. I think one of the things that gets compromised in the journey of faith is the failure to set aside regular times to remember. There's a reason that remembering is the most common theme in the scriptures. I once read a source that says it occurs 267 times. Because God, knowing our human condition, knows how easily we can forget. And so we have this constant reminder to remember. And that raises a devotional question. How do we remember week in, week out, who God is, what he cares about, and how he has done things in our lives? For some people, it's journaling, which allows them to go back through the rearview mirror and rekindle situations and be reminded again of God's faithfulness. For others, it's set aside in times for meditation and contemplation. But those who fail to remember are going to be awfully prone to forget. And when we fail to remember, we can become a prodigal son in an instant, even though we've never left home. So one of the things I think that's underscored here at this moment in time is this importance of remembering and what happens to us when we fail to do that, because here's the profound thought, I think, when we take time to remember. We realize that we belong. That we belong to God, and we are part of his family.
Now, just an aside, well, not really an aside, this is central. We got to remember what Jesus is doing here. He's addressing a group of Pharisees and teachers of the law, along with a group of tax collectors and sinners, and he's just delivered two other parables, parable of the lost sheep, parable of the lost coin. He's setting up this third one, and he's explaining about how the kingdom of God works. And so what Doug is saying is pertinent to what Jesus is trying to accomplish here, not just how we might understand one aspect of the parable, but this is what Jesus is teaching them at that moment.
And to go back to the parable of the lost sheep and the lost coin, the common theme of that teaching, and this is a cluster of teachings, so this theme carries over here, the joy of restoration. The joy of having the lost found. the joy of bringing the lost sheep back into the community to be part of the flock again, because mercy and compassion are missing in this Pharisaic culture for people who don't behave like they expect you to behave. And therefore, when you come back, you're to be punished. And the whole notion of joy is missing. And they have a works-oriented theology for you to warrant forgiveness, to achieve restoration. And it's called contrition and retribution. Mm. And what's important here is this returning younger son has no capacity to meet the retribution, or to meet the retribution high bar, because he sold the land. There's no way he can ever get the land back. Mm-hmm. And so there's a theology in the background here that if you're unable to perform retribution, you can't be forgiven. And Jesus is just going to shred that paradigm in this story. Okay, we're getting a little bit of ahead of ourselves here. But what Jesus is working on at 30,000 feet is, I am going to challenge and then remake your view of God and your understanding of God's forgiveness and your understanding of God's compassion and mercy, okay? You've got a misshapen view. It's a distorted view, and that paradigm needs to be correct. And so I simply point that out is because, as A.W. Tozer once said, the most important thing about any one of us is simply this: what comes to our mind when we think about God. Our view of God is the most important thing about us. It shapes everything about who we are and how we do or don't respond to God our Father. And therefore, Jesus is really doing here at 30,000 feet is he's teaching a view of God that the Pharisees have never comprehended, have never thought about. Simply is not a part of their lives. And as we all know, changing paradigms, particularly deeply entrenched paradigms, is a very, very difficult thing to do. That's what Jesus is doing here. He's shredding their paradigm of their view of God's mercy, their view of God's compassion, their view of God's understanding of contrition, and their view of joy.
Now, do you think, how do you think they're reacting at this point in Jesus' presentation? Are they getting restless? Are they a little uncomfortable by now?
I think Jesus is building to a crescendo here. So far, except for the opening verses where the Pharisees were stunned that this father would actually give his inheritance while he was still living, that he didn't either banish his son or, worst case, kill his younger brother.
That would have been legal, wouldn't it?
That would have been permitted, mm-hmm. Okay. They were stunned by his reaction, his acceding to that request. And now they're back to situation normal. The younger son has gone off. He's totally messed up. He's totally depraved. He's totally about to lose his life. And all of what they're saying is, he deserves it. You know, so for the last few verses, they've been in a groove of, yeah, I get that. And Jesus is now about to blow them away with how the father responds when this son returns. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here. If the most important question in life is, what is your view of God? C.S. Lewis said, the second most important question to ask is, what is your understanding of God's view of you? And the third most important question is, what is your view of yourself? This younger son finally came to a view of himself that squares with his with reality. When he says in verses 18 and the first part of 19 in chapter 15 of Luke, I will get up and go to my father and tell him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight and no longer deserve to be called your son. He now sees himself, most important question, number three, okay, for who he truly is as a sinner. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we all fight against and lean against. It's so easy to fall into the grading on the curve notion of, well, I'm actually better than most people. My behavior is better than most people. I must be better than most people, and that's good enough. But we lose the absolute standard. And so back to the number one question, the most important question, what is your view of God? I've thought quite a bit about this. The two most important attributes I've come to understand that we need to know and understand about God is, one, he is holy, and two, he is sovereign. All of the other attributes of God, his compassion, his mercy, his grace, his goodness, his righteousness, are shaped by those two, I'll call them umbrella attributes, something that transcends all of them. Because it is a holy grace, a grace unlike any other, and it is a sovereign grace. He exercises it when and where he will, okay? So when we think about God, the two most important things to remember is he's holy and he's sovereign. Let's just take holiness for a moment. R.C. Sproul once said in his book, The Holiness of God, which came out 30, 35 years ago, I believe, that when the holiness of God is the yardstick, is the measuring rod, is the plumb line, the difference between you and I and Adolf Hitler is lost in the rounding.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard that. Mm.
Question number three of the three most important questions in life. Number three is, what's your view of yourself? And the moment that we see ourselves as relatively good, grading on the curve, on the far right of the Poisson distribution curve here, we lose our understanding of sin, and we discount our sinfulness and our need for God's forgiveness and grace. But when we see ourselves compared to God's holiness, we are all Hitlers. Mm-hmm. And the difference gets lost in the rounding. And now we have to particularize sin and say, I am a dreadfully sinful person. And that then opens us up to approach God for his grace, his compassion, and in his mercy. And it's fascinating here. I believe that's what's happened to this son. The word sin shows up in this passage, in this parable, for the very, very first time here. And now he's beginning to have a very, very realistic sense of himself. Not just some general understanding of sin, but of his own personal sinfulness and the need for mercy, compassion, and forgiveness. And now, at least, he's ready to go home.
Doug, put us in the shoes of that younger son for just a moment. He did an awful thing to begin with. But we lose the significance of that act. Give me my inheritance now. And what you're telling me is that he now realizes how horrendous and how awful and how sinful, if you will, was that particular act. That's a realization.
It was beyond the pale.
Yeah.
It's just...
Well, explain the meaning of that in the Jewish idiom when he asked for the inheritance.
What he's saying publicly is, Father, I wish you were dead now so I could have my inheritance. Mm-hmm. And to say that to a father who's living is like the penultimate insult. It's off the charts. And because there are no secrets in a Middle Eastern village, what he said was probably within an hour is known all throughout the town. And so, you know, not only has he offended way off the charts his father, he shamed the community. And all of that makes it very hard for him to come to a decision to go home and face the music. I mean, for starters, how will his father respond? It's not a sure thing. Even though he is familiar with his father, he's lived with him for the better part of 30 years, he still is not sure how he will be received. And then there's his younger brother. How will he be received by them? He can just almost hear the vitriolic words day after day. I told you so, you rotten, crummy, dirty individual. And he doesn't want to have to deal with that.
And he has to bear in mind he's done something that could get him the death penalty. He could be legally stoned to death for what he just did.
And that's his third concern. If he goes back to the village, they may actually stone him for what he has done before he even can get back to his father's house.
So that's the magnitude, and that represents our sinfulness in this whole story.
Absolutely. We deserve death. Mm. We're on death row. We just haven't been executed yet, so to speak. We haven't died under that condemnation. And so those are very appropriate parallels. And it's all part of the apprehensiveness of the younger son that he has to deal with as he comes to his senses and says, even the servants in my father's house are better off than I am. And so he decides to return. But he needs a game plan to return. And so he hatches this scheme of, I want to live off campus. I don't want to deal with my elder brother. I can't stand his religiosity. I can't stand his hypocrisy. I don't want to hear that stuff day after day after day. He'll never let up. He'll never take his foot off the accelerator. And so I'm going to live off campus and be a 1099 independent contractor working for my father.
Mm-hmm. A hired man, hired hand.
Yes. Yeah. But at least, you know, for the noontime meal, I can eat with the servants, so I'll get fed. Maybe part of his logic is I can earn some money this way to actually buy some of the sheep and goats back that I liquidated. And, you know, maybe partial retribution will be helpful in this case. Obviously, he can't do total retribution because he can never reclaim the land that's been sold. And so he comes up with this hired hand scheme. And as he walks home, I wonder how many hours did he spend practicing his story, his apologetic, if you will, his defense and request that for his father. Mm-hmm. And lurking in the background is, how will his father respond? Lurking in the background is, how will the village respond? Lurking in the background is, how will my elder brother respond? None of which is perhaps encouraging to him as he trudges back home, probably less than a day's journey, at most a day and a half. We talked about distances way back in the beginning here. But still, quite a long time to practice your speech. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should finish up with this and we'll pick it up next week. All of this is known by the father. The father anticipates what the village might well do. He anticipates what the elder brother might do. He understands the trepidation, the fear, the anxiety, the uncertainty of the returning younger son. He knows, like all of us, how at the very last moment we can flinch and turn in the other direction of the resolve that brought us to that point in time. How we're most vulnerable just before we're ready to do our thing, if you will. And so this father wants to do things that will head off the uncertainty of his returning younger son about how the father is going to receive him. He wants to turn off any possibility that the village might do something destructive or injurious towards his son. And so he scans the horizon day after day to see, is this the day my son will return? Is this the day I need to put my head everything off plan in action? And one day he sees a silhouette on the horizon. A little while later, he discerns it may well be his returning son. And he runs out to greet him. And in running out, all sorts of messages start to be communicated both to the younger son and to the village. And that's probably where we ought to pick it up next week.
And just a reminder to, again, those listening who have maybe missed the first five installments of this, the community is a factor here. That's the unseen presence in the whole story. And if you go back and look at the parable of the lost sheep and the parable of the lost coin, a community celebration was in the offing in each of those parables. And the same is true in the parable of the prodigal sons. So we will pick that up next week. And I want to let you know once again where the Doug Greenwald is a senior teaching fellow at Preserving Bible Times, wonderful ministry based in Columbia, Maryland. They have a gorgeous website, and they offer all kinds of resources for your church library, books, and they've got our recordings of the Digging Deeper program on CD for you. Excellent catalyst for your small groups and Bible studies. And the website, well worth a visit. And when you go there at preservingbibletimes.org, you might want to consider signing up for Doug's monthly newsletter. It's delivered via email. You'll look forward to it every month. There's no cost. And it's just packed with those wonderful aha moments that we experience whenever Doug visits us here. So, Doug, thanks so much. It was a good session this morning. And this will be up as a podcast, by the way, if anybody wants to download that and listen to it or share it with somebody else. It'll be available in the next hour and a half here on the Broken Road site. Doug, have a great week. We'll look forward to next Wednesday.
Thanks, guys. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Shalom, shalom.
Shalom, shalom, Doug.